from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, writer Dave Eggers returns, this time with a much-anticipated new novel, A Hologram for the King, which follows a struggling, middle-aged American businessman working in Saudi Arabia. Eggers joins us to discuss the book and one of its central themes, the decline of American manufacturing. We'll also get the latest on his efforts to promote college access and literacy for youth. Dave Eggers is founder and editor of McSweeney's and co-founder of A26 Valencia, which is a network of nonprofit writing and tutoring centers. That's all coming up on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Dave Eggers returns to Forum this hour to discuss a number of topics with us, especially his most recent book, A Hologram for the King. The author of six previous books, including the American Book Award-winning Zaytoun, which also won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. He's founder and editor of McSweeney's, which is a San Francisco-based independent publishing house. He's also co-founder of 826 Valencia, a nonprofit writing and tutoring center for young people based in San Francisco's Mission District, with sister centers presently based in his hometown of Chicago, as well as in New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, Boston, and Washington, D.C. A Hologram for the King is a novel all about a man named Alan Clay, a 45-year-old sales executive who goes to Saudi Arabia to sell the Saudi king, Abdullah, IT hologram technology for the king's new economic city. Dave Eggers joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and delighted to have you back here. And I ought to say that, I ought to lead in here by saying that talking to Joe Stiglitz the last hour brings me right to your novel, because he's written so much about the necessity to manage globalization, and you're really pretty much grappling with how globalization and its bad management has led to some of the disasters and difficulties for a man like Alan Clay.
Yeah, it's... It was interesting. These things are connected for sure. I mean, Alan Clay, in this novel, he was in manufacturing most of his life. Well, he started as a Fuller Brush salesman and then went into manufacturing at Schwinn, which the famed bike company that used to make all their bikes on the west side of Chicago.
So I had a Schwinn as a boy.
Yeah. I mean, they were built like tanks. They were fantastic bikes, and they were basically, you know, more or less handmade there on the west side of Chicago until the mid-80s. And then, of course, they had some tried to bust up the union a little bit, and then they went to they outsourced things to Mississippi, then they outsourced them to Taiwan and China, and pretty soon the brand sort of lost its way and was sold for a small amount of money to Trek eventually. So and Alan Clay found himself sort of unwittingly or not, or, you know, complicit in all of this, and he sort of finds himself adrift and out of a job.
Complicit, but then a victim, because he's kind of a latter-day Willie Loman in some ways. He goes by the old rules. He's an anachronism. He's even some really good jokes in here, by the way. One I wish I could tell on the air, but I can't. but the sense is that, you know, he's living with a smile and a shoe shine and doing all that those salesmen used to do, and it doesn't work in a digital world anymore.
No, he's, you know, this is a guy... When he meets somebody, he goes into old-time storytelling jokes, and he's not finding too many people that appreciate this. He comes off as antiquated and maybe even irrelevant. But you know, he goes to Saudi Arabia and he finds his guide Youssef. It actually is the first person in a long time that's appreciated that humor. But you know, his salesman rules, you know, which he has to have this constant veneer of optimism and happiness and levity. But I think most people at this point are either seeing through it or not seeing him at all.
Well, Youssef appreciates the humor, but those when he goes with Youssef to his father's place and says jokingly, "I'm a member of the CIA," it's taken very seriously. I mean, you're really sort of showing, well, a world of Saudi Arabia. You're opening it up to us. And, of course, I think many of the readers of this book, and I enjoyed the book immensely, would say, how does Eggers know so much about Saudi Arabia? And the fact is you were there, I guess, weren't you?
Yeah, I always do my research. I've been fascinated to go there. I mean, the whole book started with I have a friend who went to this, it's called the King Abdullah Economic City, about 5 years ago, to sell IT. And anyway, the rest of the story is completely different than the novel, but I was interested in, you know, King Abdullah is making these cities in the middle of deserts, you know, right? This one King Abdullah Economic City about an hour north of Jeddah is just rising out of nothing on along the Red Sea, and he's trying to prepare for a Saudi Arabia when the oil runs out. So these are centers of manufacturing and education and tourism. And but, you know, when I was there, there were maybe 2.5 buildings constructed and a lot of hope and optimism, and a lot of the, you know, the money for the development had dried up. So there's a lot of people sort of standing there waiting for somebody else to make a move, which to me really sort of symbolized the state of the world economy at that moment.
So it could have been other places in Saudi Arabia.
Could have been anywhere in the world, I think. Yeah. There's places like this all over the place. And I think that there are American salesmen throwing Hail Marys in any kind, any part of the world, trying to sort of make that one deal that might set them up. I mean, Alan's up against it. His daughter's dropping out of school because he can't pay her tuition. And
home's about to be foreclosed. Bad credit with Banana Republic. I mean, yeah, he's a man. You put him up a tree, really. And how does he get down? Well, maybe by going to Saudi Arabia. But he does go to Saudi Arabia in large part because they feel he has a connection. He knows someone who knows the, I mean, he's related to the king. And that's how that world works, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say in Saudi, you really need to know a royal to get a business deal done there. And he knows a nephew of King Abdullah that they were sort of worked together maybe 20 years ago on a plastics deal. And so the IT company that he's working for, Reliant, says, well, you might as well send this old anachronistic guy to along with the team to see if that makes a difference, because without him, they might have no connection at all. And so he's this, you know, extra thumb, you know, with the team and walking around not really knowing if he's useful or not, but waiting for that moment when he could tell Abdullah, hey, I know your nephew, and hoping that that makes a difference. But most of the time, they're waiting.
So why your name is very Beckett-esque, in fact, waiting for the king that we get. And I noticed Beckett first, as soon as you open the book, the epigram. But do you name him Clay intentionally? And I mean, names can be tricky, and I realize that, but I couldn't help thinking intertextually of a play you may know by Leroy Jones, who's now a Mary Baraka, called Dutchman. It's about a character named Clay, who is in Dutch, you know, I mean, because he's been molded and fashioned by the forces around him.
Well, it wasn't a reference to that play, and I expect you to always know more about these things than I do. But I do like the name Clay for that reason. And this is a man who's stuck in a way. You know, you have these nightmares where you're trying to run, but you're running through clay and your legs aren't moving, and you think that you're, you know, there's this illusion of progress, but you're not going anywhere. So, I don't know, not to put too much on it, but I do like the name, and I think it's mostly Alan, and he's just this everyman name, and I tried to think of the name that would actually have as little content as possible. You know, you can sometimes overthink a name and put too much weight on it, and then every time you see it in a novel, you're taken away from the story because you're thinking about what the author's trick is with that name. But with Alan, he's a guy. He's this guy from Boston, from Chicago, and he could be anybody.
He's just what we used to call a regular guy, in fact. We're talking to Dave Eggers. His new book is A Hologram for the King, and a regular guy who, boy, there's one, well, I want to talk about a few moments in the novel. But before I do that, I want to talk about what you do in the way of representing women. I mean, the whole sense of women having cell phones, for example, and the changes that are going on in Saudi Arabia is just starting to drive. And actually, women who, in one instance, he meets a Danish woman who invites him into a bathtub. And then later on, he falls in love, I think, with this woman who is a doctor. And there's that whole sense in Saudi Arabia of things changing. I mean, she has him get in a pool with her, for example. I mean, there's a lot of water here with women. I don't know what one makes of it. But, you know, I was just struck by that sense of you recognizing that things are starting to creep smally open up.
Huh? I think I talked to a number of women when I was in Saudi Arabia, and the women I met are incredibly well educated. But there are opportunities for entrepreneurs. There are thousands of businesses owned by women, but obviously there's all these other Byzantine rules that are beyond belief. And the most visible being the inability to drive, and that's being defied every couple months. Somebody does a new provocation and puts it on YouTube, for example. And I think that, there's a large portion of the population, especially the young and educated men and women, who want change and are really frustrated and exasperated. And they're having a little bit of a brain drain where these young, very well-educated Saudis have nowhere to go, nothing to do. So they leave the country to seek their fortune or opportunities elsewhere. So I think Abdullah is, cognizant of this. And that's why some of these new schools, there are co-ed universities here and there that are popping up that seen as a little bit of a nudge toward progress. But the women especially are both incredibly adept and genius-like at circumventing some of these rules and, living a life close to what they want to. But then at the same time, they are, incredibly frustrated. And you see a lot of women that are beyond frustration, and there's depression, and there's, worse. But I think that in this case, the women that we meet are very good at navigating those rules and getting some semblance of what they want. But, of course, this is tied to class and money and education, too. The wealthier Saudi women are better and more able to do that navigation. But the country has, obviously, a long way to go.
So I don't want to give away much of the plot. I'll give away as little as possible. But do you give Alan a tumor on his neck so he can get a woman doctor's hands on him? Because that's what happens.
You think? Well, this is a guy it's been a long time for him since he's had any human connection, really. He was very unhappily divorced and is still very scarred from that experience. And I think hasn't waded back into those waters for almost a decade. And Zahra is the first woman that has, that he feels a connection to, but it starts with him touching this area on the back of his neck that he presumes is a tumor that's slowly sapping all the life from him. And once the first moment she touches it, automatically it sort of feels better. She dismisses it, that it's nothing, and she'll get rid of it. And of course, that's for all kinds of reasons, he sees her as sort of a savior. And but of course, even that romance
I don't want to give away too much here, Dave. Dave Eggers with us talking about his newest novel, A Hologram for the King. But I was also struck by how difficult it is for Alan and for many of the characters in the book to communicate just on any level. I mean, he loves his daughter. He keeps trying to write to her to express his interior life to her and to communicate with her. And there's a moment in the book that reminded me. Have you read Paul Bowles? Do you know his?
Oh, sure. Sheltering the Sky one of my five favorite books ever.
Well, I was reminded of Sheltering the Sky, particularly because of the difficulty of the gap, the chasm that exists just in terms of communication with these Saudi workers and his not understanding them, them not understanding him. I mean, you were really getting at something fundamental there.
Well, that's, the daughter's name is Kit, and that's a little nod to Sheltering Sky, which I reread every couple of years, and I like it more every time I read it, and it's so hypnotic to me, and obviously it takes place in the desert, and so I had to reread it when I was writing this. But, yeah, he's 5,000 or so miles away from his daughter, and they keep missing each other, and all he is left with is this basic trying to write a letter to her to express how he feels. And it ends up being sort of a confession of his own failures. And why is it that the one thing, especially a divorced dad like him, his responsibility is to send her to college. And she's played by every other rule and done what she's needed to do. And all he had to do was pay for it when she got into the college of her choice. And he can't do it. So as a man, and as somebody that, again, has a not such a good relationship with his ex-wife, the one thing that he's tasked with, he can't accomplish. And I think it's, you know, incredibly emasculating for him. And I think that he's struggling with that with Kit and trying to explain himself through these letters to her, and maybe slowly coming to the conclusion that, you know, he put himself in this spot, you know, or did he, and how much is the tight corner he's in his own fault.
Well, he's a tragic hero, really, in many ways. Maybe not so much a hero, but really a tragic figure. And again, Dave Eggers is with us talking about his newest novel, which is called A Hologram for the King. And I'm glad to say, wearing a Giants hat. I think last time you were here, you had a, was it a Cubs hat? I think maybe a Chicago with a big C on it.
Really?
I think so.
Well, I'm a little bit, I have that problem.
Well, no, but listen, maybe it was White Sox. It was American League. Not a National League competitor. You mentioned Sheltering Sky is one of the top five novels. You want to name the other four for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I just made a list for the week, you know, that magazine. They make you mention a bunch of other books that maybe influenced the writing of this one. And I mean, those are the ones that are off the top of my head. And I mentioned in this list, I put Dangling Man, which is, you know, Bellow's
first
novel that man went waiting to find out if he's drafted, and which I thought it was really important to me a long time ago, and I go back to
before your time, 1947, yeah.
But it reads like it was written yesterday. I mean, so much of it. And Bellow, I think, still has that ability, that electricity on the page that's almost unequal.
Well, because you're Chicago-born, right?
I guess, you know, but, you know, really the novel I push on everybody is Herzog, and I have no idea why. I have very little in common with his protagonist, but to me, every page, there's more happening and more sort of lassoing of all of
too.
Life, yeah, on every page than anything else I know of. And so I meant, you know, Dangling Man I put on, Sheltering Sky, I put Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre, just because, you know, this has a little bit of a...
There's a feel of that, yeah.
You know.
Existential despair and nothingness.
Exactly.
Those nice things like Beckett gives us, too.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, Something Happened, the Joseph Heller's
book. But that's about really the ad agency world, though.
Yeah, but, you know, as sort of an American businessman that feels like all of his the best years are past him. You know, he fought in World War II, and for what? The right to do nothing, you know, to sit in
the last good war, John Osborne called it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for naming those. And we also ought to get out of the fact that 826 Valencia is right at its 10th anniversary. I mean, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah.
It's a milestone, a big
milestone.
It's
kind of incredible. It's sort of snuck up on us in a way, but we started in 2002. And you know, the programs have grown pretty steadily, and we've been, you know, just blessed by thousands of volunteers that have helped us make all kinds of new programs possible. And we've been guided by the educators in the city who have told us how we can be useful. And I don't know, there's something every week that kind of astonishes me, the way that it's taken off in all these new directions and driven by the staff. And so
I mentioned, by the way, for listeners who don't know, it's a tutoring and writing center for youth, especially for underprivileged youth. And they're now in how many cities? I think I ticked them all off. Eight cities. In addition to the Mission District in San Francisco. And you've been doing so much. I can't say enough positive about the work you've been doing, just in terms of literacy, in terms of college accessibility. And this was in many ways kind of an organic outgrowth of 826, wasn't it?
What?
The work that you've been doing, like on tutoring, and led to the desire for more college accessibility and work on literacy.
Well, everything about 826 was really organic. We started with just the idea that we would be, McSweeney's used to be part of 826. We would, the editors at McSweeney's sat in the back, and at 2:30 or 3, we would put out a sandwich board in front and say free tutoring after school. And then all of our editors and freelancers would become the tutors in the afternoon. And that was the extent of the idea. It was going to be very basic. And then it just kept growing and growing. And Nineveh Caligari came on as executive director, and she was a teacher in the city, and she grew it, you know, to its, exponentially more. And then as the kids start aging up, they start wanting to go to college. And of course you get involved. And, You find students that can't pay for college or students that need help with college essays or SAT prep, and so we design programs for them. And then we find that the UCs and the CSUs, you know, are getting more expensive, so we have to come up with, you know, financing work for, you know, plans for them. So that's where Scholar Match, our college access.
Which we talked about with you, I believe, the last time you were on Forum.
Yeah.
And it's been getting a lot of support. It's been really... engendering a good deal of support, has it not?
Yeah, it's been doing really well. We've had we are about to send another class of 40 students to college this fall, but it's tougher than ever. You know, like it is a minefield. The way that these kids, the things that these kids have to think about and their parents have to think about is incredible. It's far more complicated than it ever has been before. Even just deciphering these financial aid packages that they get is so daunting, and we have to do so much hand-holding and one-on-one attention to that and to, you know, helping with the families decipher these things that, I don't know, it's still, I think it's incredibly difficult and very disappointing sometimes. Like even when a student will get into a great private school, I had two of my favorite students drop out this last semester because they couldn't afford the loans anymore. They were seeing $22,000 a semester stacking up in their future and thinking, you know, they're theater majors at, you know, NYU or something. How are they ever going to pay this back? So they drop out. And so there's a long way to go, and we have to get even smarter about sort of where the students are going to go and going to be and leave school without too much debt and be able to actually start their lives. And this is like, I think, a national crisis right now.
It is a national crisis. I mean, there's more student debt now than there is credit card debt in this country, which a lot of people can't conceive. But again, you know, you're right down there in the trenches, and I commend you. I think it's also just not only an ongoing struggle and a challenge to find a way out of this morass that we're in, but also to find ways to... make public education simply more of a bastion. There was a piece you did a while back that I happened to see in the New York Times where you were saying everybody seems to be blaming the teachers. When things go wrong with the military, they don't blame, you know, the soldiers. They don't they don't blame the captains or the lieutenants. I thought it was a very good analogy, very telling analogy.
Well, you know, it's so easy to blame the teachers when we'll create these, I think, sometimes unrealistic and sometimes arbitrary goals for test scores. And we say you have to raise all of your test scores this many points within a calendar year, or your jobs are on the chopping block, or the school might be closed, or these incredibly punitive measures all the time. And I think that it's sort of, I think it's well-intentioned. We want the best for all of the students in the country, but these high-stakes tests, this constant teaching by rote, this kind of, constantly punitive and punishment-oriented approach to things is just not the way to best educate our students. And, you know, I was thinking the other day, I have a high school class called The Best American Non-Required Reading, and we edit an anthology that comes out every year, and these are high schoolers from all over the Bay Area that come. And we meet every Tuesday night in the basement of McSweeney's, and we discuss contemporary literature, and we read the Kenyon Review and the Paris Review and Granta and Mother Jones or whatever, and then we go at it and talk about these things and the issues that are raised in the stories. And it's so great and electric, but if I were being tested, or if the students were being tested at the end, it wouldn't be any fun anymore.
Our guest is Dave Eggers, and you can join us in conversation here. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the phone number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page or our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're spending the hour with Dave Eggers. His new book is A Hologram for the King. You know, I was just actually thinking, it occurred to me, I've read all of your work, I've read all of your wife's work, and Vendela Veda, and to some extent, when you were talking about Sartre before and all, there's a little bit of a convergence here in terms of just that sense of a very different landscape, in Turkey, Northern Lights, whatever, but also a world which has become, in many respects, one that the protagonist is struggling against in an alien environment.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I heard about this King Abdullah Economic City, this sort of city rising from dust on the side of the Red Sea, it felt to me, you know, just the right place to set a middle-aged man sort of looking back on his life and finding himself lost. And, you know, there's nothing better for an existential novel than an existential landscape like that, where there's only a few objects, there's a limited number of people. And the whole, you know, the landscape is so surreal. But, you know, he is in that place where, you know, is he completely responsible for his fate? Is he, does he have any agency at this point in his life? And
I can't help thinking of Bello again, you know, Augie March. Fate is our character, or character is our fate, you know, which is it? I mean, you're playing with that, aren't you?
Well, I am. I mean, I think that, and you know, you mentioned Death of a Salesman. Obviously, this is a little bit of a, you know, it is a little bit of a successor to that, you know.
But forgive me, the real successor in some ways with Salesman, which we go back to Chicago again, was David Mamet's Salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross. He's not that kind of salesman. He's more the Willie Loman, isn't he?
Yeah, although
he's got some of that in him.
Yeah, you mean like the Jack Lemmon character? I'm sorry, I just saw the movie, so I'm that's as close as I can come. I can't
Levine
remember
is his name. Yeah,
yeah, where he just wants the leads. If he can just get a few more leads, I think that Alan owes a little bit to him, but I think Alan is even further from that, you know, grasp. I think that Jack Lemmon feels like he's just within a few inches. If he can just get that lead, then he can make the sale. And if he, you know, but I think that Alan is further adrift. I think he's lost the map.
Well, he's not ruthless and unscrupulous. And Shell the Machine Levine, played by Jack Lemmon, is both of those things.
Yeah. No, you know, he's more of a guy that I think he's sort of, you know, I think that the state of, you know, where a businessman like Alan is in sort of an industry like the bike industry that he used to be in, it was a death by a thousand cuts. Like, he was part of the team that kept outsourcing the manufacturing and kept on sort of chipping away at the integrity of the business. And then suddenly he finds himself just as superfluous as the American workers that he, you know, put out on the street. And so I think that part of this time in the desert by the sea is him coming to some realization that, you know, that he's put himself in this desert, that, you know, he's the sum total of his small actions and the small decisions that he made, all that seemed like the right thing at the time, now have put him in this place where he has very little left.
Well, that's what I meant by a tragic figure, because traditional, classic Aristotelian tragedy, you know, the character comes to the realization in consciousness of what's led to his fate, as opposed to Willie Loman, who never really realizes what he's done or how he's done it. Talking again with Dave Eggers in his new book is A Hologram for the King. And by the way, 826 Valencia had a book that just came out recently with an introduction written by the great Ray Bradbury, who just passed away.
Well, this was my best American non-required reading class. We always ask an author to write the introduction to it. And the students voted unanimously. All these kids are 16, 17 years old. One of them mentioned Ray Bradbury, and all of them said, yeah, let's ask Ray Bradbury. And he was 90, I think, at the time. He just passed away at 91. And I thought, okay, well, who knows if we can get Ray Bradbury to write the introduction. But there was a young guy named Sam Weller who works with him, and he said, okay, I'll have Ray dictate it. And so Ray from L.A. dictated this introduction, and he just turned it in a few weeks ago, and it's incredibly beautiful. And the kids were so moved that he had done it, and then he passed away, you know, a few weeks later. So as a guy from Chicago, Ray was from Waukegan, a few miles from where I grew up. He meant a lot to me growing up. It's also one of these things where you read him in school, and then I remember, like, in eighth grade, one of my teachers saying, well, he, you know, he's from down the way and he's still alive. And that was the strangest thing. When you read this canonical writer, you can't believe he's still alive as a kid. And here he is all these years later having, you know, produced this great body of work. But he was the real deal. He was a true hero of mine.
And talk about people who made a big difference in your life. Maury Sendak, of course, just passed away as well. And you're going to the funeral tomorrow?
Yeah, I have to leave from here and get on a plane, and there's a service for him in New York where everybody gets to pay tribute to him. So I think it'll be a really nice event organized by Tony Kushner, who is, in the last handful of years of his life, really incredibly crucial to Maurice. And so it's going to be incredibly hard, I think. But at the same time, I think it'll be a celebration. I think that there'll be a lot of very funny stories because Maurice was incredibly funny. And the stories that I thought of right away to talk about at a service like that were all pretty raunchy, I have to say. You know, like any conversation with Maurice was, you know, pretty raunchy. Like he had a really distinct and mischievous sense of humor. So he was far from being this sort of safe, older, gentlemanly children's book writer. I think he was.
There were wild things brewing in his imagination.
Yeah, he never lost that sense of sort of the wild, and I think he fiercely actually protected his ability to sort of say what he wanted to say, and I think that a lot of people got the benefit of that through that like recent Stephen Colbert interview that was on the air and Spike Jonze's documentary. I think you got this sense that this guy hadn't lost a step and he was true to himself and authentic to the very end. So,
did you know Maurice before you did the Where the Wild Things Are?
No, it was Spike Jonze that introduced me to him. And before we got started, we went up to his house in Connecticut. And basically the task that he set before us is to try to make something as dangerous as the book originally was. And it was considered a very controversial book when it came out, Where the Wild Things Are. And Bruno Bettelheim said, don't leave it in your kid's room at night, and it'll somehow corrupt them. And so he wanted to make the movie just as dangerous as the book was. And
Bruno Bettelheim also said that mothers were totally responsible for autistic children. I mean, he said a lot of things that caused a lot of danger and, I mean, a lot of consequences. I want to just add, I want to get to our listeners. Did you know Kathy Goldmark? We're talking about people who just passed because she was someone very dear to me, and I just wondered if you knew her.
I did. It's been such a tough month for the world of books. I knew her in the small Bay Area literary community, and you know, the Rock Bottom Remainders did a big benefit concert for A26 some years ago, and Kathy was instrumental in that. And, you know, she's just one of those necessary forces. You know, you need the Kathy Goldmarks of the world to sort of connect everybody, because I think sometimes the world of writers here, it's, you know, the old herding sheep analogy, and I think Kathy was one of those organizers, connectors, forces of nature that made it all come together.
She was that indeed. She was also a wonderful spirit. And let me bring some of our callers on. Alexis, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Eggers, I actually just wanted to thank you, and I do have a quick question, but thank you first. I'm a teacher. I will be teaching at Mission High next year.
That's a great school.
I'm very excited, and I'm actually going to be teaching Zaytoun in tandem with Nine Lives.
Wow.
And I can't even explain to you. I feel like you've done a lot in terms of, I'm a teacher of color, I teach students of color, and I feel like you've made reading very accessible. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. So, sorry, I get teary because I just feel like you're so instrumental in transforming a lot of the Bay Area.
Well, we're at Mission High all the time, and that's the main high school we work with. You know, we're four blocks away, so when you teach the class, let me come in and talk to the students. We're there all the time anyway. So let me come in. Just tell me when. And I can't wait. I always have a bunch of Mission High students in my class. And most of the scholars that we send to school through the 826 scholarships over the years have been from Mission High because they're so incredibly well prepared. And get this. One of my favorite students ever, Terrence Lee, is graduating from Stanford this year, and he went to Mission High. And what does he want to do now? He's getting his teaching certificate. So he's going back to Stanford to get his degree in education. He's going to teach math and science in San Francisco at the elementary level. So how inspiring is that?
That's incredibly inspiring.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'd love to obviously have you in my classroom. Somehow I'll figure out how to contact you. I'll figure it out.
Oh, it's easy. Just walk into the pirate store. Leave me a note. We'll figure it out.
You had another question, though, Alexis?
Yeah, but sorry. My quick question was if you have time to speak about the American Teacher Project.
Yeah.
I was just curious what inspired that. And I'll leave everybody alone. But thank you for taking my question and comment.
Thank you. Hi. American Teacher is a documentary that came out about a year ago about the lives of American teachers, public school teachers. And it came out of a book that Nineveh Caligari and Daniel Moulthrop and I wrote about teachers' conditions, salaries, and the state of the profession and the perception of the profession. And then we thought it would be a good idea to bring it into film, and we follow five teachers through their lives and sort of the day-to-day work and sort of how gifted they are and how great they are as educators and how many struggles they unnecessarily go through and the burdens of the profession, including Jonathan Dearman, who was a teacher here at Leadership High, who had to quit because he couldn't afford to teach. He couldn't afford his teaching habit. And he was one of the best educators the city ever saw. And then Eric Benner, another narrator in the movie, who is down in Texas, who loses his house and marriage breaks up, all of this because he can't afford to provide for his family in the way that he wants to because he, again, the conditions of the work. But the movie isn't all grim. It's not all dire. It's inspiring, I think, too, to see these teachers at work. And so it's out there on DVD if anybody wants to get it.
Did you see Waiting for Superman?
I did.
What'd you think?
I think Davis Guggenheim is a great guy. I think he really was well-intentioned. I think he wanted to, raise an alarm about, the state of education or sort of bring attention to some issues. I think one of the unintended consequences of the movie was that it really it came down real hard on teachers and teachers' unions, and I thought that was
and also kind of elevated charter schools to a level that perhaps was maybe too great.
Yeah, and this is what happens with a 90-minute movie. Sometimes there's, you take on a lot of different subjects, and a subject as complex as American education, and sometimes you leave people with an impression that you might not have wanted to leave them with, including the people that walk out of the theater thinking all public schools are bad and only charter schools are effective. And it's a shame. But I would really encourage, and what 826 Valencia tries to do is get people in the community to walk into your local public school, Everett Middle School and James Lick Middle School, where we have tutoring, satellite spaces, or Mission High. Go through 826. We'll bring you into these schools. We'll introduce you to these educators. We'll see these teachers in action, and I think you'll be inspired, and all the sort of the headlines and scores and all that stuff, I think will at least be put in context when you see what's actually going on in the schools.
There's a listener, Wanda, who says, we are losing a lot of very good teachers who won't teach to the standards being foisted onto the children. Much of today's curriculum in lower grades and higher education is getting hijacked by business. Commerce would like schools to produce employees. Traditionally, school has helped students to mature as people, function within their culture, become members of a democracy. Ironically, while very good teachers are leaving the business, there is a lot of whining about bad teachers we can't get rid of. There's no talk of helping them improve. There is no talk of helping them with their financial planning because teachers don't pay Social Security. They pay into another fund. That credit is not transferable or accessible to the teacher who doesn't retire from the profession. Who wants to lose 12 years of retirement credit that is not transferable?
I can't say it better than that. That's one of the absurd, truly absurd aspects of the lives of teachers. And the absurdities are manifold and all of them pretty frustrating. But I'll go back to that teaching to the test and the rote that the caller mentioned. Again, as I teach this one high school class one time a year, but for 10 years I've taught it every Tuesday night, and if I had to think of some high-stakes test at the end of the year that determined whether or not I was a good teacher or whether or not the students were prepared according to, whatever they were supposed to have learned in this class, which is a wide-ranging, I think, in very intellectually vigorous class where we get to talk about all kinds of issues and everything, but it's not by the book. There's nothing that's standards related or anything like that. If I had to worry about all of that at the end of the year and this high stakes test that determined my worth and the kids' worth, I don't know if we would all do it. It would take a lot of the free thinking, platonic, sort of peripatetic sort of beauty of teaching and learning and mentoring out of it. So I don't know. I think we have a lot of thinking to do about not necessarily applying spreadsheet methodology to what is a much more organic and not always quantifiable process, which is education.
Well, as you know, I'm an educator, and I tried an experiment just last semester. I did a class in it was 20th century British and American literature, across the pond, as they say, but also neocolonial, so went to Africa as well. Decided, I'll say 10% of the grade will be based on quizzes, and the quizzes were designed to say how much would the students retain. And I realized that it didn't necessarily foster much. I mean, you could design a quiz and show perhaps that the student is reading or absorbing or learning or retaining and everything else. But what does it show compared to the quickening, the igniting of ideas, the creativity that can come about in conversation and discussion and analysis and interpretation? It's a little bit ludicrous. Let me get some more callers on here. We'll go to Lola. Good morning, Lola.
Hi. David, I love your work, and I love you, Krasnator. But do your
what,
do
what
your
did kids, you call me? I'm sorry.
The Krasnator.
Well, that's a new one. I'm sorry.
I love it.
Are you going to send your kids to public school? Do you have children? I think that particularly in California, with the shortening of the school year, and it's just a scary gamble. And you know, I'm Mexican, and my husband's black, so my son's, you know, half black, half Mexican, and it just seems like we look at the outcomes for boys of color in public schools, and it's just terrifying with the schools being so resource starved.
Well, there are incredibly great public elementary schools and middle schools, and high schools in this city and in the Bay Area generally. I think, yes, I'm a public school guy. My kids will go to public schools. I don't want to go into incredible details about where they go or anything like that. But yes, I went to public school all the way through college. So I have it in my bones that education should be free, or at least for. But I would never judge any parent for sending their children wherever they see fit. And that's a personal decision. You can't make a blanket statement, and you can't foist any sort of ideas or values on anybody else. So I think whatever feels right for you, and I think the Bay Area has so many great choices. And, you know, if your kids are in elementary school, I just did a benefit for McKinley Elementary, which is an incredible school, that wearing a shirt for Dog Fest. They put on this big dog festival to benefit the school and brought in thousands of members of the community to sort of see what's going on at the school and learn more about it and support it through their love of dogs. But there's a lot of activity, there's a lot of innovation, and there are so many great educators in this city. So give it a shot, at least, I would say.
And thank you for your call. And here's Adam, who says, can your guest speak to the concept of choosing an appropriate major which is aligned with the amount of money these kids will have to borrow to obtain their goal? Liberal arts and or acting majors are fun and fulfilling, but are like the lottery when it comes to getting a good paying job after graduation. Seems like there is need for guidance in choosing an appropriate major.
Yeah, I have my high schoolers go off to college and they say, should I major in creative writing? And I say, you're going to whatever, Syracuse, and you're going to be incurring however much debt. I can't in good conscience advise the two things, majoring in a very esoteric or, subject like that and incurring $150,000 in debt. It doesn't make sense. I left the University of Illinois in the black because I worked through college and I actually ended up, with money to spare. And so I was unencumbered, and I can't imagine what a student that's coming out, especially a first generation low income student coming out of college with $100,000 in debt or whatever. It's absurd. It's crippling. It inhibits their choices. It inhibits their ability to sort of study what they want to study. And they have to think of more sort of practical mercenary concerns right away. And it's not right. We have to do better. And actually my high school students, three of them from Unity High in Oakland, this great small high school, put together something called College for California, which would, a proposal that they were trying to get on the November ballot, it didn't work, but maybe someday, it would make college at the CSUs and UCs free for all California residents, And all it would take is like bumping up the tax rate for those making over $250,000. You bump it up a percent or two, depending on where you are, and it would pay for all the tuition for all of the California.
You do
residents.
The math; it could be done.
Yeah, it's what is it? $3 billion, something like that that you'd need, and I think that the people making that kind of money might support it too. And businesses might support it if they know that. I actually think it would be good for the economy, good for businesses if they knew that, all of our employees, all the Google employees, all of the Apple employees, all of their kids will go to school for free eventually. I think it's good for the economic development of the state. Now, obviously, it fulfills the promise of higher education that, the UC system was supposed to and still does as best as they can offer to the residents. So, educated state is a strong state and a democratic state and an economically viable state. I think we should do everything we can to plan ahead and make a proposal like this real, as opposed to the very chaotic, ad hoc, kind of all over the place plan that we've got right now for higher education.
Used to be, though, if you got a baccalaureate degree, there would probably be a job for you. Mm. And, you might have incurred a great deal of debt, but the fact of the matter is that the economy was humming along and there were positions for people in the liberal arts. Now it's become increasingly difficult. I mean, you used to have the argument, especially in the 70s, that you go to college and you don't necessarily go to find job training or a union card. You go there for the liberal arts and expand your knowledge and your consciousness and so forth. That argument doesn't hold up for many young people today. They want essentially to pay off their debt. They want to put food on their table.
They have to, or at least those kids that don't have trust funds have to. It actually widens the economic divide, where there are some kids that get to make, sort of any choice they want to after school, or delay their, or they don't have to worry about debt. But the students that are caught right in the middle, and a lot of it's just middle class students that have to incur this debt, they don't qualify for the grants the same way that they would, and they have to make choices, career choices. And even college choices based on this idea of debt. And I think more and more I find students, four of my students this year are all going to City College. Why? Because it's cheaper. So a lot of students now are doing 2 years of credit at community college because it's far cheaper per credit, with the idea that then they'll transfer to UC and finish up their degree. So people are trying to work this system in a way that's just... I think it's unfortunate. Everybody's trying to sort of get around the cost and try to figure out a way to get it done. And it feels, again, very chaotic to me. And I don't think it's good for us in the long term.
Our guest is Dave Eggers. His new novel is A Hologram for the King. And we'll have a caller on. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for a great show. And appreciate both the show and Dave, your writing and your work with students is extremely inspiring to me. And my question is a little more self-centered than sort of conversation has been, which is for those of us who sort of find ourselves in midlife who are struggling to make time for our writing and pursue that, given all the responsibilities of adult life and especially financial responsibilities and that sort of thing, I find in the writing community that I'm in that everybody's constantly struggling just to have time to eke out, say, a chapter or something like that. I'm just wondering if you have any advice or thought on, for those of us who are far beyond the scholarship age, about how we might be able to make writing a more integrated part of our lives.
That's a great question. And first of all, I think that the world needs more writers who have lived a bit and are coming, increasingly. I think MFA programs should be accepting people from different walks of life, different stages of life, people who have had kids, who have worked, who are going back to writing and have something to say, who have lived a bit. So I applaud you doing that. And
or even had other careers. You think about someone like Abraham Verghese going to Iowa and Writer's Workshop.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, some of the I would say whatever you do, set a daily or a weekly goal. And I'm mentoring a couple people I know right now where they send me 500 words a week, and because they've got full-time jobs. And I say, just send me 500 words a week. And one of these writers is 220 pages through a book that's taken, a year and change. But she's been sending me 500 words a week from Brooklyn. And now she's at a point where she's got a proposal together and she's sending it out to agents. And so set a realistic goal for yourself And 500 words is good, you know, if you're very fast, maybe 1,000 words a week. And before you know it, within a year, you might have something, and also get yourself in a writer's group with people, you know, in the same situation that you're in, so you can give each other feedback, give each other deadlines, hold each other to some, you know, to your best writing selves, and set a yearly goal. And I think that
you write a page a day, you got a book at the end of the year, right?
There you go. Yeah. A page a day.
Unless you're a binge writer like I am, unfortunately. But let me thank the caller and get another call on, and that's you, Linda. Hi.
Hi. This is Linda. I'm calling because I would like to ask Dave if this 826 Valencia project is available in the Contra Costa County area.
Well, not right now. There are always groups that are trying to bring the 826 type program to new areas, and there's been great interest in bringing the concept to Oakland for many years, and we hope that someday there is a center in Oakland. But we'll see. So far, it's some very interesting people that are trying to do it. But right now, the students that we work with in Contra Costa are usually coming to us in the city.
Let me thank you for the call and an email that's important to read by Angela. Just to conclude here, she says, I'm a public school teacher, just retired after 29 years in the classroom. While I agree that the current testing craze can destroy students' interest in learning, I want to emphasize that it would be catastrophic to believe that it's an either-or situation, a false dichotomy. In fact, without the tested skills of reading comprehension, writing, grammar, and mathematics, without the ability to memorize, the student will be unable to communicate clearly any of the wonderful creative ideas he or she might have. Let's not throw out skills in the interest of creativity.
I agree. It should be both.
Dave Eggers, always good to have you on.
Nice. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Again, the book, A Hologram for the King, his newest novel, seventh book. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.